So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink. Now, if you caught my recent episode with Natalie Bedard, you'll remember that we explored what happens when we stop fighting fear and start releasing it, how resistance softens when the body feels safe enough to let go. But what if we go one step deeper and ask where that fear comes from in the first place? Because for many of us, the patterns that keep us gripping on to alcohol, to control, to perfectionism, they don't start in adulthood. They began as survival strategies connected to trauma long before we ever poured a drink. Today, we're going to go to the roots of that story with Dr. Yvette Rose, an internationally renowned holistic counsellor, trauma recovery expert, and author of, 21 books, including the global bestseller, Metaphysical Anatomy, Volume 1. Your body is talking, are you listening? Yvette has worked with over 7,000 clients and taught trauma-informed healing in more than 43 countries. Crikey. Yvette's work helps people understand how past experiences, even from early childhood or previous generations, leave emotional imprints in the body that shape how we think, feel, and cope. And together we're going to explore how trauma isn't what happens to us, but what happens inside of us, and how alcohol can become one way our nervous system tries to manage pain, stress, or disconnection. So this isn't just about sobriety, it's about healing at a level where our patterns first began and finding freedom not just from alcohol, but from the old wiring that made it feel necessary in the first place. Welcome to the show, Yvette. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much, Anna, for that warm welcome. That was like a red carpet experience right
a
there.
Red carpet of introductions. That's the benchmark I've got to go for. Brilliant. So I've got to ask, though, is there anything you'd like to add, anything that I missed out from the introduction that you think is important to add?
You nailed it. However, it's funny because every time when people say, oh my goodness, 21 books, you know what it actually really is, Anna? It's 21 breakdowns.
Okay.
That's what they are.
Still admirable, though.
It's 21 breakdowns. And I documented all those ugly moments and everything that went on in between. And I turned them into books.
That's amazing, yeah. Though, but it's prolific. It's prolific. And I know your work has helped so many people, so many people. And as you say, you know, globally as well, which is absolutely brilliant. And that's what I really want to dig into today, because I think this episode is going to be dynamite. All right. So before we...
No pressure.
Exactly. So it's all downhill after that intro. Anyway, before we get into the science, I would love to begin with your story, Yvette, because so much of your work now helps people understand how early experiences shape who we become. And I know that alcohol played a role in your own family. So can you share a little bit about experiences growing up around alcohol and what that environment looked like for you?
That's a great question. So I'm just going to lay it out on the table. I actually found out quite a while, many years ago, that my father actually happened to be a clinically diagnosed sociopath. And on top of that, he was a full-blown alcoholic. He was a self-medicated drug addict. I will never forget the days, Anna, where we dropped him off at rehab. And he's like, I'm going to come back a new person. This is it. You know, we got this, you know, God is our savior. And he's walking in there with the Bible under his arm, comes back 2-3 weeks later. And, you know, he will be there for a month. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, he's back to where he started. Mm. And we dropped him off 5 times. So it was 5 promises broken, 5 too many.
Crikey.
It was a tough upbringing. I was the only child as well. So there was no one else to share the burden with. And he was the violent alcoholic as well. So my wiring, my need for safety was met by distress, feeling attacked and feeling belittled and ridiculed. And so this is what started to shape my identity and my sense of self as I progressed and moved throughout my life. And that was my introduction to alcohol. And interestingly enough, it also became my introduction to how do we cope with stress. He had a very high profile job. He worked so hard and he was good at what he did. And he was so good. But he was the top performer who would go to the bar or sneak out lunchtime, you know, sneak in the alcohol before we go to work. And he was the one that always had his backups everywhere. And he got caught one day and he lost his job. He lost his prestigious job. And that was it. And he would just continue to drink. But one thing that really stuck with me was, oh, so this is what we do when we don't know what to do.
Yeah.
This is how we cope with stress. This is the fallback. And this is something, and I remember it from a young age because I kept telling my mom, Mom, you know what? I don't want to become like Dad. You know, he's like this and he's like that. And even though I said that, something else was being programmed very deeply within me because he was not a safe person to connect to. He was not a safe person to be with. Mm. And indirectly, I didn't realize how I started gravitating more and more as a teenager to alcohol because I so deeply wanted to connect with him, so deeply. But I couldn't talk to him. Let me tell you, when you try to speak to someone with his neurobiological setup, it's not like you and I are having this conversation. They see the world differently. They feel differently. They act differently. And then on top of that, you become a lot more apathetic as well when you have drank a lot of alcohol over many years. And he was at the point where he was in and out of that psychosis as well. So it was a very messy, intense situation to be in. And what I realized that the more I missed him, or at least just that longing for a father, which we all have that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how grueling your parent is, it does not take away that inner childlike need for that parent. It just doesn't take it away.
No, of course. And I'm sure that there are going to be people listening to this who have grown up as children of alcoholics who are 100% agreeing and hanging on to what you're saying here.
And I latched on to alcohol as a way of just stepping into his world to connect with him.
Mm.
I subconsciously started to associate alcohol with being like him and feeling connected to him because it was a safe way of connecting. And so my need for connection with him was replaced with alcohol.
Because I was going to ask you, you know, what did it teach you even unconsciously about love and safety and connection? And I guess what you're saying is it was the door through which you could step into his world and feel those things.
Yeah, exactly. Because I couldn't ask him what was your favorite color. I couldn't ask him how was your day. Because he would just come down on you like a ton of bricks and start screaming and shouting and like, what do you think it was like? It was awful. I hate my life. You know, I hate my job. And he was a very negative person.
Mm.
But he was also that very negative, volatile person with an exceptionally high IQ. You can give him a page of paper to read and you can ask him cite the 5th paragraph and he could do that. Like he was highly, highly intelligent.
Very complex character. really complex character.
Yeah, he definitely was. And what he also taught me through alcohol and with the way that he treated me was that alcohol and love come together. So I ended up choosing partners who had alcohol problems because that was my reference for love. That was my reference for love from a man. And it felt so familiar, even though it felt so painful. It was like a moth drawn to a light. You know it's going to burn you, but you still go.
The fact that that then carried on, if you like, into the partners that you sought out.
Yes.
That is a classic case of how children, obviously, as you were when you were growing up and you were in the sort of the family home, internalize those patterns of coping and, you know, the emotional regulation, the sort of the anchors that they have from what they exactly witness and from what they experience, right?
And that treatment as well, drinking, all the self-abuse was, oh, that's how we have a relationship with ourselves, right? That became my language subconsciously. When I love myself, when I nurture myself, when I need to take a break, I hit that bottle and I would hit it hard, right? So it was all about learning how do I redefine even my relationship with myself, my self-love. What does it actually really mean, right? It was a complete breakdown of my psyche that I had to do. I literally had to redefine who I am as a person because you lose yourself in it. Completely.
It's so powerful hearing you use those terms and to sort of think about how those really early imprints can live on beneath the surface, not as our fault, but literally as our inheritance. And is that what you would define intergenerational trauma as being, Yvette? That sort of sense that those learned strategies for survival are sort of passed down in that way?
Exactly. I actually have several points that I would like to share there with you because we know how alcoholism can be a very strong predisposition that can be passed down, right? Mm. So not my mom didn't touch alcohol. She hated alcohol. So she didn't drink while she was pregnant with me. But the alcoholism was very strong in her family DNA lineage and in my father's family DNA lineage. The predisposition that came to me was so heightened. It was so sensitive that I was one of those people where I just pick up one glass and that was it. That's all it took.
From a very, very early age. And
yes.
Yeah, and okay.
That's all that it took. Yeah. Because of that heightened sensitivity to alcoholism and that subconscious association that, wow, this is my coping strategy. Because these memories, these messages are passed down from our DNA lineage. And another point that I also came to learn when I worked with a lot of people with alcoholism is I love to do regression. I love to learn and understand what is going on in your body, apart from the cognitive mind in memories. What is the somatic memory in the body? What is the memory of the nervous system? Because that's the hardest language to decode. It doesn't come with words. Mm. That nervous system, it records everything from when you are born until you are three, because it's very right brain gestalt, right? So it's all about eye contact. It's all about hugging, experiences, physical contact. And the more there was trauma experienced during that vulnerable 3 years, the more it also predisposes a person to be potentially vulnerable to extreme sports, depression, alcoholism, addictive behavior, addictive patterns. And what people don't realize, and here's the beauty of this, I have come to learn that this is a big part of the nervous system that can heal if it's taught that eye contact is safe, the vocal tone, it's safe. Did you know by just changing the tone of your voice the way that my voice is now, it regulates the nervous system instantly when you speak to someone? Just the tone of your voice. Now imagine that tone of voice becoming loud, screaming, shouting. It dysregulates that nervous system, right? So all these memories are constantly being lodged in, and the more anxiety and stress and trauma we feel, the more we start to peak to a certain level of stress where we hit that threshold. And when we hit a certain threshold and there's a strong predisposition for alcoholism, oh my goodness. You know what's kicking in into the body? Where's the alcohol? Where's the alcohol? It's looking for it. Why? Because that solution, in inverted commas, was passed down. And now you hit that threshold and the body's looking for that. It's looking for that incorrect solution. So that's another point.
So basically, early conditions, chronic stress, everything from...
It goes earlier, Anna.
And yeah, well, I was going to say, because when we first had our conversation, when we first met, you talked about how things like chronic stress in childhood, you know, how you're parented, those looks, the tone of voice, all of those things are early conditions that prime someone to be susceptible. But you amazed me with something that you said around earlier, even stress during fetal development. Can you talk to me about that a little bit? Because that just blew my mind.
We're going to touch on fetal development and then we're going to go back before preconception because it goes actually deeper. So with these thousands of people that I have worked with, let me tell you, when you start to see patterns, Anna, I don't care if there's research out there about it or not. I don't care. It becomes an undeniable truth. And every time when I regress people who struggle with alcoholism and the sensitivity to that, every single time I find heightened stress in the fetal developmental stages.
Every time.
Every time. Every time. And I'm hear me out, because I know this is going to challenge a lot of people's belief systems, and I'm perfectly fine with it because I'm the one that's getting success and results with my work. Okay. So I intuitively was drawn to this cell in the lining of the placenta. And I'm thinking, my goodness, what is this? What is this? Because I progressed a few people back and a few people said, because when I asked the body, not them, I asked the body, where is this predisposition? Where is the stress being held that is so early? And it came into a protein cell that is part of a bigger cellular structure that is in the lining of the placenta. And now I'm Googling and I'm looking for it. And you know what? I found the research. And it was very near research where scientists finally discovered that a mother's stress is held in the lining of the placenta. In the lining of the placenta. Now, why is this significant? The placenta is the startup of your being. It's the startup of your being. This is what tells your nervous system how to act and react. This is what tells your mind and your body how to develop. Develop on what?
It's on trauma? It's the nutrients on which you all bring life to.
All of it. But not just the nutrients, but the cortisol from the mother that's flooding the fetus. As a healthy amount's needed for growth factor. But if this is too much, it becomes toxic. It has shown to cause speech problems, cardiovascular problems. People who have heart attacks, who are very prone to heart attacks, who supposedly have no heart problems in their DNA lineage, where is this coming from? Go look at the womb. Go look at the fetal developmental stages. I ask people, tell me about your mother's journey while she was pregnant with you. Tell me about that. Because that stress, that heightened trauma and stress, that sets up a very strong predisposition and a heightened sensitivity for stress. Hence why a lot of people can crack so fast. It can crack so fast. And when they do, it can set off the coping strategy that's been encoded in the biology of the body. We need alcohol when we crack, when we fall apart. So you see how even an inheritance combined with the fetal developmental stress can set you up for such an incredibly powerful yet disempowering experience. And then
takes the impact of alcohol to a whole new level, right? Because
it really does.
You're saying that your mum didn't really drink, but her experiences of living with an alcoholic,
it was horrific.
Horrific. And that then impacted the conditions in which you were even conceived and developed as a fetus. It's incredible.
Have you ever heard of frequency matching? Dr. Candace Pert is my hero. She talked a lot about this, and especially electromagnetic field. it's shown that the people that you hang out with the most, or that's physically the closest to you, can influence your cellular structure and how you feel, and how your neuropeptides respond, influencing your emotions. Well, if that can affect her while she was pregnant with me, what does it mean for me, despite the fact that I could still not at that point cognitively, of course, interpret my life? But what does that mean for me? Where do these little messages go sit and lodge in my body and being held, and to the point where I am one day able, after birth, to observe and see, oh, well, this is how I'm feeling. Oh, now these messages are being kicked wide open, and now they're flooding the body as well. What about that? This is a neuroscientist. What about that?
It blows my mind.
It's mind-blowing, Anna, but now you also understand why it can feel so gut-wrenchingly painful to address an addiction, because we don't understand it. We don't understand the depth of where it can go. Okay, well, now we know, but what do we do with that? What is next? Right? Mm-hmm. So even sometimes a lot of great data can leave a person feeling completely perplexed and exacerbated, because, okay, this is amazing, but now what? So this is where I dive, you know, so further and deep down into my journey, because it's the inherited trauma. It's the fetal developmental trauma. It's your childhood trauma. It's associations that we formulate with alcohol as well. That narrative that we tell ourselves about it as well. There's almost 10 points that I can count on my hands that's important to address, and that deserves to be given time and attention to if you are really looking at changing your life.
It's incredible, Yvette. And I think the thing is, obviously...
Can I pause on one more point just before I forget?
Yeah, for sure.
Because we're still at the early stages, right? We're going to go one moment back. I'm going to surprise you. We're going to go one moment back. So what's also important, yes, we're going to go back to Dad. We're going to go back to your father. What was he doing when he was 12 or 13 years old? Was he smoking? Was he drinking? Was he doing something that related to addictive substances? What trauma was he going through? Why is that so significant? Because that's when the gonads were being formed. And this is researched. That program gets passed down. Now, what about your mother's mother? Because you were already in your mom while she was in her mom. Was she drinking? What were her stress levels like that she passed down to your mother, that she then passed down to you?
Was it your ambition today to have me fall off my chair in disbelief?
Because
I'm sort of slightly speechless.
I mean, please watch the documentary, a BBC documentary, Ghosts in Your Genes, as well, for you and for everyone else that would love to just learn and understand a little bit more about how trauma can be passed down, because it is incredible. For me, and I'm going to be really honest with you, if I had to listen to myself a few years ago, I would think that this person is batshit stir crazy. Like just completely you lost your mind. But when you start to see results in people that have done everything and tried everything, and now suddenly you see things are actually moving and shaking purely by using their own mindset, this blew me away. It blew me away. And it took a couple of times, a couple of moments, you know, trying and working through it, including with myself, where I was like, okay, well, maybe I feel a little bit more safe to talk about this now, because this really stretches our capacity and our understanding of how beautiful, amazing, and yet incredibly complex we are.
I read a book several years ago, a couple of years ago, by Oprah Winfrey and Bruce Perry, and it was a brilliant book, and it really opened up my mind. It was a sort of sense of it sort of shifts that story of addiction from what's wrong with me to what happened to me, you know, that they're so often being trauma beneath, you know, the behavior. But what you're actually saying again is it's not even what happened to me, it's what happened to my mum, what happened to my dad, what happened to generations before, and not in that sort of learned drinking behavior that we necessarily think gets passed down, that sort of you know, nurtured behavior, but actually biologically as a result of coping mechanisms that they have had, or, you know, sort of stress and trauma that they have had in their life impacting physiologically on the next generation.
Yeah. It's mind-blowing. It is mind-blowing from my perspective, just what I have seen. Just what I have seen. As an example, I'm going to share a case study. As an example, I had a client who, and just in a minute to just show you the power of this, who had a parent who lost a parent. And this person's father grieved so much because of that loss and drank and drank and drank. And what's interesting is that this person didn't really get to meet this father a lot. So they were not exposed to the patterning of what was happening. Yet he came to me with unexplainable anxiety in his heart, severe depression, clinically diagnosed, right? And drinking a lot. And I'm thinking, wow, what is going on here? Where's this habit coming from? He did not have any knowledge of his father having a drinking problem. He knew his father drank, but not to the extent where he could say and confirm, yes, he has a drinking problem.
Mm.
And you know how we found out what was happening? When we gave the body a chance to speak, not the mind, the body.
Mm.
Because the body holds a different story and a different narrative that is not influenced by this complex prefrontal cortex that has an opinion about 10 other things, and it has an opinion about an opinion about an opinion, right? It's a very straightforward, beautiful place and space to connect to where you can get straightforward answers. I always teach and speak that we have the consciousness of the soul, which is how you're experiencing me right now. You're hearing me speak, you understand me, you can feel me, you can connect with me. And then we have what's called the consciousness of the biology. This is the biology of the body that it wants food, it wants success, it wants to feel safe. It's very basic experiences, very, very basic, very primal, very human. But I do feel that there is a beautiful another aspect to us, which is the soul, which is that consciousness, the awareness of the I. There's a difference between you and me, right? So, and when we tap into the consciousness of the body, it's going to give you different answers. And when we did that, when we regressed back and we connected to the feelings in the heart, what were the feeling sensations? Whose face would you see, your sense or voice? And he kept saying, I felt my dad, and he's so sad. And he said, I really feel like I want to drink right now. And I'm like, oh, wow, is that you, or is it maybe your dad? And he said, I actually want to, but I'm seeing my, I feel like it's also a behavior that's coming from my father. And I thought, wow, this is so interesting. So we worked on it and we released it. And he did some research, went and asked his mother about the father, because the father already passed, and she said yes. She confirmed everything.
Mm.
How, Anna? I mean, his body told the story.
Absolutely. I mean,
that's called trauma transfer. In my work, I call that trauma transfer. Trauma transfer is when data is transferred between people that's genetically related. And research is heavily, heavily researching this phenomenon now, because I can share multiple case studies of trauma transfer.
No, I bet. And like, one of the things that's occurring to me whilst I'm listening to this, hooked, literally hooked on what you're saying, is that there could well be people listening to this who think, well, my drinking's not really a problem, so I don't think that data got transferred. I don't think I have those issues. I think I'm all right. I don't drink that much. I don't have a problem, so I must be fine. But I guess, you know, alcohol is just one such coping mechanism, right? And such data transferred narratives pass through at a sort of a cellular level, show up in different ways as well. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because not everyone who comes to you is drinking, are they? There's other stuff going on as well, behaviors.
So, oh, I mean, I can use myself as an example there. Smoking as well. Smoking is exactly. Another. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was smoking 30 cigarettes a day, and my father was smoking 30 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
Right? And so it was, again, that needing that connection with him. But one thing that I noticed and saw is the emotions that a parent feel, that people that we look up or connect to feel, this is behavior that we can also copy, and we do it subconsciously. So when we do hit that moment of feeling unresourceful or feeling vulnerable, vulnerability is normally the culprit. There's something that we feel vulnerable in and something that's not resolved. And when we go, when we move into that place of vulnerability, it fires off that trigger of looking for different coping behavioral strategies that we witness because we ourselves don't know what to do. It's coming from that place of unresourcefulness. Even though we can know and feel and see that this is probably not the best way, it feels familiar.
Yeah, and that is exactly what I was talking about. It's the ways in which we, I suppose, subconsciously repackage emotional pain.
Exactly.
Burnout, chronic stress, relationship dynamics, you touched on those, the kind of people you seek out, the, you know, what defines safety for you, you know, all of those kind of things, you know, they all tell the nervous system the same story in a way, don't they? But it manifests itself in many, many different ways.
But I do want to touch on what I was also just saying there, because something that people often underestimate, especially when we talk so much about how the nervous system regulates itself when we, you know, when we drink and we want to regulate. When we have an addiction challenge, we're looking not just at the addiction, we're looking at an ecosystem experience. Because when we drink alcohol, and this is what's regulating us, there's certain people, there's certain circumstances that also is involved in that. And there's a deep desire and need for things to be and stay a certain way. And normally, you know, when we can often maybe be in unhealthy circumstances. And this is also how we end up feeling regulated by these unhealthy circumstances, because it's associated with the alcohol as well. Oh, I start to feel better now. You know, this person that used to be so bad, it was not so bad. Everything is okay. And you're co-regulating in really unhealthy potential circumstances as well.
This is so fascinating.
I saw that in a lot of clients as well. So I thought I just would mention that for you and why a lot of people sometimes would have an unhealthy partner, but this partner is part of the, and the alcohol is part of the co-regulating process. It's like it's an ecosystem.
I love that use of the word ecosystem, and
it really is
about joining the dots, isn't it? So if you have an ecosystem that can create, sustain and continue these behaviors, then it's really about joining the dots and understanding all of the factors that are at play. And I think what's really, of course, very, very empowering about this in a way is that we can move past the fact that people see themselves as something that needs to be fixed, you know, because it's also alcoholism or any form of isms like that, you know, aren't our fault. And what you're suggesting is that they are, you know, they started maybe generations ago. And they were coming your way in some shape or form, potentially. So it's not necessarily something to fix, but it's about people understanding, anyone who's sort of fallen foul of these issues, understanding what it is that can make them feel safe again in different ways, which is obviously where your work comes. This is all about the safety, isn't it? It all comes back down to safety.
But here's the other thing also. I would love to touch on something that you said that was so important. I need to fix something. I need to be fixed. If we look at ourselves, I need to be fixed. All that you're going to see is problems. Energy flows where your focus is. So that's what we're going to continue end up energizing. Your body's like, oh, you need something to fix? Oh my God, you think this is an alcohol problem? Here you go. Here's all the other stuff. What about the negative thoughts? What about the anxiety? What about the depression? What about the fear of public speaking? Here we go. And it's overwhelming. You cannot be solution orientated if you go into your body and your mind and your life and you think that you want to go and fix something. You cannot be empowered at the same time. Real, true healing starts when you go into that with a solution-oriented mindset. So rather than looking at what is wrong, what needs to be fixed, what needs to happen next? What about that? Rephrase, what needs to happen next for me to live my best life? And then what needs to happen after that? What needs to happen next? What can I improve? The energy of it shifts your whole physiology.
Yeah, what needs to be nurtured from here on in. Yeah.
Exactly. It's the fact that you are solution orientated. You cannot find a solution if all that you see is problems. You are in the completely wrong frame of mind.
Can I ask you then, because this is going to be, you know, an obvious question. There's obviously the deep work that can be done. And by the time somebody comes knocking on your door, Dr. Yvette, can you please help me? Can I please engage with you? There is a sense of sort of self-awareness potentially there that there's work to do. And you are clearly profoundly good at doing that work. Of course, healing itself isn't just a mental understanding. I get that. We have to feel and we have to practice it in the body. So your work is so powerful because you do dig into those narratives, but also because you give people real tools. I mean, real tools that they can use in those moments when they feel triggered and restless or, you know, on the edge of old patterns. And so for someone who is, maybe they've got that work to do, that sort of depth of work to do, but for someone today stuck in a destructive loop, whether that's drinking or overworking or whatever it is, what are the one or two simple regulation practices that you could encourage them to do? This is a practical part.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, what I love to do is to, when you breathe in the mouth, out the nose, just 13 times and focus on the stress that you're feeling and where you feel it in your body. And then you just breathe into that place in your body and then you exhale out your nose. And the last breath you hold as long as you can. And while you're holding your breath, you're going to move into a very beautiful, safe, quiet space. And it's so inviting and it's so expansive. And when you are in that space, it's there to remind you silence exists, calmness exists. And that trigger that you have, that trigger is going to dissipate. It's going to dissipate by at least 40%. And that already is a huge win right there with an exercise that takes you seconds. The second exercise, I'm going to share three with you. The second one, what I absolutely love, and I love to say that I am safe. Now, it might be something different for everyone else, but whatever it is, apart from maybe a trigger that you have, you know, with the heightened emotions, if it's a trigger in relationship to needing the alcohol, what I would do in that moment is, what would that alcohol give you right now that you cannot feel or have by yourself? Whatever that answer is, let's say safety, or I am free. What I love to do is you can just cross your hands like a little butterfly on your chest, and just on your chest, and close your eyes, and just look straight ahead, and just close your eyes. This is called bilateral tapping, and just keep repeating, "I'm safe, I'm safe." And this might take 5 to 10 minutes, but you're going to start to feel that very belief that you are tapping on. And secondly, the one that I find works really well that I give my clients as home play, I don't say homework because we don't work, we play into healing.
is I love that.
Right? So this is a beautiful process that came from EFT. So when you feel the alcohol trigger, where in your body do you feel that desire? So I might now say in my mouth, okay? All right. Now, as you connect to that area, just playfully, who do you see, mom or dad? Just randomly, who do you see, mom or dad? All right. Some people might say, well, maybe my grandfather, now what? Okay, well, whose side is it on, mom or dad? Okay, just it sticks. It's either mom or dad. There's no other gray area. Let's say I'm saying, okay, I feel it in my mouth and I'm seeing my mom. Oh, okay. All right. So remember, left side of the hand is mother. Right side of the hand is father. It doesn't matter if you're left-handed or right-handed. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change it. So now what you want to do is when you look at your hand between your pinky and your ring finger, down on the top part of your hand, on that little groove there, now you're going to tap. Tap and tap and tap. And what you're going to do is you're going to imagine your mom. You're going to imagine that desire in your mouth. And you're going to cite and say, you never gave this to me. It was never passed down to you. Meaning, we don't need to know what it is. But the body, it will know. And it's feeling that lack. Now, what lack? The lack that would have or could have made you stronger in whichever way, form, psychologically, emotionally, or physically, to be more robust to this addiction. Because at the end of the day, it's normally lack of safety and lack of love. It just escalates and takes different ugly faces.
I love that. Escalates and takes different ugly faces. How, I mean, I was going to say, do these practices actually begin to help to rewire the imprint rather than just provide relief in that moment?
So what I just shared with you right now, this is how you can start to create relief. This is where you can start to take control of it, right? We're taking control of this right now. Mm. But sometimes real, true, deep change, when we start to look at addictions, it can sometimes be gnarly trauma for some people. Mm. And yeah, I don't want any big triggers for anyone and then I'm not there to help. But this is beautiful and this is safe and it is highly, highly effective. Highly effective.
What you've just described there, be it the breathing, be it the butterfly on the heart or the chest, and be it the tapping, what's really noticeable here is it's just you, your breath, your body.
That's it.
There's no investment, no equipment required, no long sessions, no long periods of time, actually. And it's incredible how accessible those tools can be and how quickly the body responds, I guess, given, you know, given a pathway back to safety. That's what it needs. It just needs that pathway back.
Exactly. And also while you are connecting to this desire, to this trigger, another point that I would love to share as a number four that helped me a lot through that awareness, with that awareness, right, is when you feel that desire, whose face or voice do you see that you know? And then in that moment, I acknowledge the difference between who I am and this person's trauma, stress, or their need for alcohol. The body has incredible ways of communicating with us. It's just a matter of how willing are we to listen, shamelessly, finally, listen. That is a powerful, conscious awareness that's brought into the mind and the body to create that separation of, well, this is not mine. That awareness can often also become a very big part of your healing. I actually have a free guided session, now that you mention it, that is safe to use. I think it's guidedhealingsession.com. Go through that. Yeah, just go through that. It's a 30-minute video. It's absolutely free. And then you can go and look and see what are the issues that's coming up. Where is this coming from? Because you're going to see what it's like to have like a, not a full-blown, but like a mini session actually with me in a safe way. And then bring in the tapping at the end of the session video.
And I'll put that in the show notes. But can I just ask you a quick question out of my personal interest? What significance does it have as to where in the body you're noticing the stress or the feelings, the anxiety?
I love that question. Oh my God, Anna, now I want to talk for 3 hours.
Oh God. I wish we had 3 hours. Make it 3 minutes.
I'm going to give you bullet points. I'm so excited now because now you really touched on my language, right? So the reason why we must ask where in the body it is, because we store specific different types of emotions in the body in different places. And it depends on the complexity of different types of emotions that have been memorized together. That can also now shift and change then where the emotions is being held in the body. And the reason for that is because of the neuropeptides that takes in this data and this information and then relays it throughout the body, including the bloodstream as well. And this is Candace Pert's neurosciences research, and then showing how negative emotions disrupts the electromagnetic field, receiving this data between nerves and the neuropeptides and the transmitters. And this is what can cause that discomfort, because somewhere in the body, something is not harmonious right now. And that's why we can feel it there. And it's so important to acknowledge that space, because when we acknowledge it, we bring our full focus and awareness to that, and we give space to it. Do we have We have time. Let's do it. Anna, we're going to do it. I want you to bring up your left hand like this for me. I want you to put your full focus and awareness on the palm of your hand. You can even look at your hand if it's easier for you. Look at
Might
your
be
hand.
Easier. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Your full focus and awareness is at the palm of your hand right now.
Mm-hmm.
And keep it there just for a few seconds. What do you notice?
I am literally giving full focus, and I'm noticing the lines, and I'm noticing the creases in my hand. Okay. Probably a bit more than I'd like to given my age.
How does your hand feel? Do you notice a tingling sensation or a buzzing or something is happening, but you might not be able to explain necessarily what it is?
There is a sensation. I wouldn't have necessarily called it tingling or buzzing, but it is definitely.
It's a sensation.
Yeah, there's something there.
Beautiful. You can put your hand down.
What's happening?
That is the power of your focus. Now what you did was you just looked at your hand and your full focus, because energy flows where your focus is. Remember that.
Of course.
And imagine now you hold a specific focus and then project it to your hand. I want you to bring your full focus and awareness to the top of your head, here at the frontal lobes right now. Bring your full focus and awareness there. And a lot of people would notice when we do that is it feels like a little bit tight or congested, or there's like a band maybe around your head. Can you feel something like that? Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? My inclination is to think that it's tightened because I'm focusing, but it's probably just tight anyway. Yeah.
No.
But No.
Good. So now your full focus and awareness continues to stay there. And now, Anna, I want you to expand it. Imagine that it's expanding beyond this universe, far out. There's so much space. And now?
It loosens.
Beautiful. And you did that all by yourself. I did not tell you how to manage these electromagnetic fields, your focus, your awareness, and your attention, because this is a God-given gift that was given to all of us. So now you ask me, what is the relevance of finding and understanding the emotion that's held in your body? You want to release it? Bring your full focus and awareness to the area. Who do you see? What do you feel? And give space. Give space.
Because I do remember in my coaching training and some of my accreditations, etc., that I remember obviously having a diagram of the body and knowing that certain emotions do get held in certain places. Yeah. But I guess what I haven't extended the practice into is the release of it, you know, the tools and the techniques for the actual release, which is obviously your heartland. But it's amazing. It's. Can I ask you? I am conscious of time, but I just want to ask you one quick question, because it's a bit of a left field question. There are people who don't know who their parents are, and there are people who might only know one side of their family lineage, or potentially, you know, many, many years ago, alcoholism and stress and chronic behavioral stuff that went on in families was often swept under the carpet and it wasn't talked about and it was all sort of hush hush. And it might be that people no longer have the opportunity to delve into their family history because relationships have broken down and or maybe their
family
parents
secrets.
Aren't around anymore. Yeah. Family secrets or relationships aren't there, or they're estranged, or their parents aren't in a position to recall, then they're not around themselves. Does that bring a bit of a cul-de-sac to your exploration? No.
Most people don't know the history of their parents. They don't fully, and no one, even if you saw your parents' entire life playing out in front of you, there's no way that we can ever understand what someone else is going through.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, in the UK, we have this sort of term of stiff upper lip, and, you know, sort of brought up sort of Victorian values, whereby I would be able to look at my mum and dad and I sort of have a sort of, I think I have a pretty good sense of, you know, what they were like when I was younger. Then it gets a bit vague, obviously, with generations before that. I remember my grandma, but I wouldn't be able to know my grandma's entire sort of life history. I'm sure my grandma liked to sherry, but if there were problems going on behind those doors, they weren't going to be known to me, and they would have been like stiff upper lip, you don't dare, or okay. You know. But I guess what you're saying is it doesn't really matter. It's the existence of that energy that gets unlocked when you do the work. It doesn't have to be pinpointed and precise necessarily.
But I'm going to share I'm going to drop a last golden nugget bomb. Something that a lot of people, not all, but most who struggle with alcoholism have in common. That main issue is feeling burned out by responsibility. Burned out by responsibility for either a parent's happiness, having to act or behave a certain way, having to be a certain way. Mm-hmm. There's this overbearing sense of responsibility of having had to be a certain way.
Yes.
Or carrying a certain load that they don't want anymore. And now it's a, well, stuff you world, I need my break.
Yes.
So there's often overcompensation for the lack of needing something in your mm-hmm. childhood, which the alcohol is now helping that person access safely.
You're absolutely right. You come at it from a different perspective and a different sort of area of expertise, but I see that all the time in my coaching.
So when I do the healing work, when we work, this is the first place that I go to. What became too much? What did you have to carry, hold up a certain face, feel responsible for certain parents' happiness, or, you know, having to hold up certain values or beliefs that pulled you so far away from your identity that you collapse under all of it? What caused you to collapse?
Wow.
Every single time, Anna. Mm. Every time.
Yvette, thank you so much. Thank you so, so much. What I've loved about this conversation is how
this is great.
It just again begins to connect the dots, yeah. You know. So I started off this. Well, it does. It has. I mean, my mind is blown. We started off this conversation mentioning an episode a couple of episodes ago with Natalie Bedard, and she helped us understand how to maybe release fear and resistance. And what you've shown us is why that fear can take hold in the first place, and the original blueprint that our nervous system creates. And it's such an important, vital, vital, vital reminder that our patterns aren't personal flaws. They're intelligent adaptations, you know, ways our body is trying to protect us when we don't have any other options, but also the power of being able to listen to those patterns and you know, what they're telling us. And we can then begin, you know, to heal at a level where it all began, which is fundamental, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's so cool. Well, I'm going to encourage listeners, that if this episode has resonated,
unless they read the transcripts,
well, they could read the transcripts. I'm sure there's going to be so much in here. People are going to be like, oh, I need to go back. So by all means, download the transcript. But yeah, do listen to the conversation with Natalie Bedard as well, because that is the other piece of it. But this is a perfect follow up to that, and I am so grateful, Yvette, for you coming on and explaining that to people. I'm going to pop all of your contact information and your work piece, your free tool into the show notes.
Please do. Yeah. For people who's really willing, who wants to go for it. And just last piece of advice, if you do would like to go through the guided healing session, at the end of that session, do the tapping. Do the tapping on the hands where I explained, and the bilateral, the breath work is in the session already. So you'll be doing that already. So you can just bring all these tools together that I explained to you.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's the beliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.